whether it's going to rain.
Well, it may not rain. Hopefully, it will rain Friday and Sunday. But we'll adjust whatever, because you can't complain too much about rain, considering our situation. But we do have a few spaces, maybe 10 or so left. If you want to sign up, you can just see me afterward, or I know a lot of you have signed up already. I don't know if you have. You guys coming? Okay. do see me afterward if you want to sign up and join us, because I think it would be fun. And we've been doing good things for 60 years, so we need to have a lot of our friends join us to celebrate. So, anyway, go ahead.
Marty will be there. If you want to meet Marty, come to the celebration. You know, he's the founder of both of Marin Audubon and of Audubon Canyon Ranch. The grand champion of the college. Are there other announcements to be made? Oh, you would like to.
On November 1st, we're going to have Keith Hansen's big day on what he calls Left Bank, the other side of West Marin, the other side of Point Reyes, starting at Point Reyes Station. So we have 15 openings, and we have 9 filled, so there's room for 6 more people if they decide they want to go early on November 1st. It'll be an all-day affair. We usually get about 100 species, close to that. So
that's a lot.
It is a lot.
It's hard to achieve that anymore. Yeah. Okay, Joe Moreland is our speaker tonight. College professor, ardent birder, all of that. Going to take it from there, Joe.
Sure. Thank you for that long introduction. Okay, folks, so I would like to talk to you about subspecies, and I'm really pleased to see so many fine, smiling faces all interested in this highly technical topic. Do notice that I have decorated the PowerPoint demonstration with a little birds. You are to write down the name of the species and the subspecies, and I will collect your papers. And this is no longer working. Oh, there it goes. So, a colleague of mine gave a program on subspecies at a conference a few years back and talked extensively about the topic, and never in the topic did he explain what a subspecies was exactly. And as we were going through the specimens that were arranged there for our edification, it became clear to me in talking to people that a lot of people there did not actually have a clear idea of what a subspecies was. And so I thought I would rectify that by explaining the subspecies concept a little bit. The subspecies concept is described by Ernst Mayr in 1963 as geographically defined aggregates of local populations which differ taxonomically from other such subdivisions of a species. No wonder he didn't want to explain what a subspecies was. And what is the definition of redundant? This seems to assume the definitions of a whole bunch of other things. But I would like to point out a couple of features of this definition, and that is subspecies are geographically defined. They are populations. They are not individual birds. So if somebody says that bird is that subspecies, they're talking about it being a member of a population. It differs how? It differs taxonomically. There's a bunch of different ways that populations might differ from each other. What does taxonomically mean? It means that the differences can be seen in museum specimens. That's basically what it means. If the differences are not visible or measurable in museum specimens, then those are not what Mayr is describing as a subspecies. So, moving on, here is the Fatuma in 2005, who's written a very good textbook on an evolution college textbook, and he has a somewhat clearer definition, I think. A recognizably distinct population or group of populations that occupies a different geographic area from other populations of the same species. Well, that's getting to be a little bit rough to understand. So, colon, populations of a species that are distinguishable by one or more characteristics and are given subspecific names. So he brings in the nomenclature aspect of it and says that each subpopulation needs to have a name. Now, the way that name is applied, most of you know this, each species has an English name, but it also has a scientific name. That scientific name is composed of two parts, the genus and the species. And the subspecies is not necessary, but if you want to name a subspecies, it's the third part of the scientific name. And here's a Strickberger in 2000, a taxonomic division of a species often distinguished by special phenotypic characters and by its origin or localization in a given geographic region. So another way of saying the same kind of thing, he talks about phenotypic characters, though. And notice that that is something that can be seen in a museum specimen. You don't need DNA to figure this out. It's something you need to be able to see. So here is another definition of a subspecies, a way of describing intraspecific geographic variation using nomenclature. It is a synonym for geographic race. And some guy named Moreland said that in 2016. And basically, you need a committee to decide which is a valid subspecies or not, because these definitions are all fairly vague. But the idea is that species differ geographically over their range, and if you have a recognizably distinct population within there, it could be described by using subspecies. So that's all subspecies are. Subspecies are merely names that are applied to populations as a way of describing their geographic variation. And more important is what subspecies are not. And there's been a number of cases, some people might even know why it is I threw a great gray owl into this slide, but populations with unique genetic markers. Just because you find a population that has unique genetic markers does not qualify it as a subspecies. And some of the modern geneticists don't seem to quite understand that, including some colleagues of mine who described the subspecies of great gray owl, Yosemitensis, from Yosemite, from the central Sierra Nevada, based only on a unique set of genetic markers. They were unable to find any measurements, any physical difference between that population and any other population. Heck, I differ genetically from you. We're not separate subspecies. So regardless of what the genetics tell you, you have to be able to see those differences. Song types are not subspecies. So you might be aware that the white-crowned sparrow has subspecies, but it also has song types. They are completely independent of each other. The song types are learned, and if a particular population sings a different song in a different part of its range, that is in and of itself has nothing to do with defining or naming a subspecies. Because? Why? Because museum specimens don't sing. You can't see that difference. Okay? It's a valid difference. It's just not a valid subspecies. All right? Color morphs. If you see red-tailed hawk, a dark morph, a light morph, they are not to be considered subspecies of each other because color morphs exist in a single geographic area. We can go out today and see light morph and red morph and dark morph red-tailed hawks, and they are not to be considered subspecies, and they do not get a subspecific name. And lastly, names applied without selecting a type specimen. Every subspecies must have a particular curated museum specimen that is the type for that specimen. And if you think that your bird might belong to that subspecies, you could go to the type specimen, compare your bird with that type specimen, and see if it agrees with it or not. Failure to designate a type means that your subspecies is invalid according to the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature. And the people that describe the Yosemitensis great gray owl forgot to select a type. They later on corrected it and selected a type, but still all they had was unique genetic markers. Sorry, that doesn't cut it. Now, the whole idea of this is that these are divisions within a species. And that brings up the sticky wicket of what exactly is a species, because there are some people that don't believe species exist, and there are other people that have vastly different ideas of what qualifies as a species. Ornithologists and people that believe in subspecies use the biological species concept, as advocated by Dobzhansky in 1937. Species are systems of populations. The gene exchange between these systems is limited or prevented by a reproductive isolating mechanism, or perhaps by a combination of several such mechanisms. So this and all of these concepts that get these fancy names because people like to argue about it and they don't want to say biological species concept. So if I'm talking to you and I say BSC, you're supposed to know what I mean. Okay, so all these acronyms are going to be coming up here pretty quick. Now, there are several competing species concepts, and I just described what the biological species concept is. Notice that what it does is that biological species concept emphasizes reproductive compatibility. Species interbreed with their own species to a much greater degree than they interbreed with things that are not their own species. So that is the focus on the biological species concept, is reproductive compatibility. There are additional ones. There's four additional ones that I've listed here: the evolutionary species concept, the recognition species concept, the cohesion species concept, and the concordance principles concept. So, you know, you need to publish or perish. So people come up with a new species concept, they criticize the old species concept, and you get a publication out of it. There is another one that I'm putting quite separately, the phylogenetic species concept. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I've put those four in a group underneath biological species concept, because it's my opinion that these are all part of and just emphasizing different parts of the biological species concept. And we don't really need a brand new species concept for every one of them. And that idea was put together in a 1999 article by Ned Johnson and Van Remsen, under what he calls the CBSC, the Comprehensive Biologic Species Concept. And here's what they did. They took all of those other definitions and piled them into one definition. An avian species is a system of populations representing an essentially monophyletic, genetically cohesive, and genealogically concordant lineage of individuals that share a common fertilization system through time and space, represent an independent evolutionary trajectory, and demonstrate essential but not necessarily complete reproductive isolation from other such systems. I almost can't believe they got this published, because that's all they did was take everybody else's species definition and pile it all into one paragraph, one very, very long sentence. Now, let's remember there was that other one that was not really part of and cannot be included very well in the biological species concept, and that's the PSC, the phylogenetic species concept. concept, as advocated by Craig Kraft in 1983. And that is a monophyletic group composed of the smallest diagnosable cluster of individual organisms within which there is a parental pattern of ancestry and descent. This is Joel Kraft from Chicago. Well, what does that mean? Monophyletic means that they all have they come from a common ancestry. They are not polyphyletic. They do not have multiple branching. So we're looking at branching, evolutionary branching, and we're looking at a single lineage, a single point at the end of the branch. That's what we're looking for. And that's going to be a group, and it's going to be composed of the smallest diagnosable cluster of individual organisms. So what we're going to do is look at the ends of those branches, and without regard to whether or not they are reproductively compatible or not, we're going to look for specific diagnosable features that we can use to identify that population. Now, this solves all of the problems of the biological species concept. And you'll see why in a minute, I think. Here's Bob Zink's version of the same thing. He is also a phylogenetic species concept advocate. Diagnosably distinct taxa with independent evolutionary histories. I think of it as populations that have a unique set of derived characters. It's the way I've always thought of the phylogenetic species concept. So any population that has a unique set of characters that you would say are derived characters rather than primitive characters. By the way, reproductive compatibility is considered to be a primitive character and therefore is not of any use in the phylogenetic species concept. So this is real similar to an old, old thing. If it looks different, it's a species. That's basically your phylogenetic species concept. It's very similar to a very old idea before modern genetics called the morphological species concept. So this is a downy woodpecker. It looks different from this hairy woodpecker. They are separate species. I know what they are. They look different. That's all it is. It's basically. And why is that useful? One of the points that needs to be made here is that if it's the smallest diagnosable cluster, it doesn't have any subdivisions. So there cannot be any subspecies in using the phylogenetic species concept, if that's what it is that you want to do. But I thought I had a slide that answered some of these questions. Look, what do you do about asexually reproducing organisms? What does it mean to be reproductively compatible if you are asexually reproducing? Doesn't work. What do you do about population A over here and population B over here and they never come together? How would you know whether or not those are the same species because they are geographically isolated from each other? They are said to be allopatric. You don't know. But with the phylogenetic species concept, that all gets solved. They're species as long as they look different, as long as there is some kind of diagnosis that you. So that helps solve one problem, but it creates a whole bunch of other problems. And the point is that this concept is, although advocated by a number of people, it is not in general use by ornithologists, and as far as birds are concerned. Here's the thing. If there are no subspecies allowed, what happens to the number of species? Everything that we would call a subspecies qualifies as a phylogenetic species. So your life list is going to go through the roof if you go with this phylogenetic species concept. So I'm surprised the ABA hasn't gone on board with this. And here. Oh, well, here's the slide that has the BSC problems. Allopatric, okay, anybody know what that is? Allopatric populations are what I was just describing, those that do not overlap. So if you have population A and population B and they never see each other, how do you know if they're reproductively compatible? You don't know. Allopatric populations are unknowable. And not asexually reproducing organisms. Doesn't make any sense. Now, there are some solutions that have been attempted for this, particularly for the allocatric problem. And that and those are objective, and I put that in quotes, scoring systems, as advocated by Helbig in 2002, and most notably by Tobias et al. In 2010. They have come up with an objective scoring system for allopatric populations, that is, populations that do not overlap. And this has to do with how different they look. Is their song different? Do they hybridize in a zone of contact? There's a whole bunch of things. And you score this on an additive sort of score. And anything that gets a score of 7 or better becomes a new species. If it doesn't, if it's not different enough, you score it as a 6, then it's not a species, it's a subspecies. So they have tried to come up with this this new system of objective scoring. What that objective scoring did in the non-passerines of the world was to create 462 non-passerine species that were not previously recognized as species. So they've added 462, and that's just the non-passerines. They haven't published the passerines yet. And this is the new system which was adopted by Handbook of Birds of the World. Handbook of Birds of the World is this multi-volume set that has all of the information of all of the birds in the world. And they have come out with an illustrated checklist of birds of the world. Anybody here own that? Good. it's the only book that has a picture of every bird in the whole world in it. So it might be worth getting just for that. And I'm talking about paintings and high-quality paintings. But the taxonomy that they use is this. They claim it's a biological species concept, but modified by Tobias's scoring system. In a review of the one-volume illustrated checklist, Alan Knox wrote that there is really no known system that can definitively identify which taxa deserve to be treated as species. And that's a fair statement. But that method was adopted by Handbook of Birds of the World, and you know who else adopted it? Is BirdLife International. Anybody here a member of BirdLife International? Worldwide conservation organization. And they adopted this new taxonomy, which adds a whole bunch of new species on there. Possibly with the idea, well, they got kind of forced into it, I could talk about that. Certainly, the more populations that are recognized as species, perhaps the more conservation interest there might be in those. But is that really a valid way of doing taxonomy? It is to do it in favor of conservation. We can talk about that if you want. So here is Moreland's view of what species are. Species are a way of describing biological diversity using nomenclature. And compare that with what Moreland said about subspecies. Biological diversity is not the same thing as geographic variation. Subspecies use names to describe geographic variation within a species. Species themselves are a measure of diversity. And you know what species are because you go out and you have a yard list of 60 species and you're not seeing a whole lot of hybrids amongst there. You know the difference between a golden-crowned sparrow, a white-crowned sparrow, a song sparrow. All of these things are digital entities. They are recognizable intuitively. They sing, they mate with each other. They recognize themselves as belonging to the same species. We basically are letting the birds themselves decide which are the species and which ones are not. I highly recommend, though, that you need a committee And by that I mean peer review. I mean people who study this kind of thing to make those kinds of decisions when it is ambiguous about whether or not population A or B, especially in the case of allopatric populations or narrow hybrid zones. And that brings us to the subject of hybrids. In particular, I had to pick myself up off the floor when I read that the Tobias system added a point or two to the score if there was a hybrid zone. I said, my God, if there's a hybrid zone, then they're not species. I couldn't understand what they were getting at. So here are some examples of some hybrids. There's a black duck cross mallard down here. There's a Brewster's warbler there. Some of you might recognize that as a hybrid between the golden-winged warbler and the blue-winged warbler. That hybrid has been known for 100 years or more. Here's one that was photographed in Southern California that people have argued about, but I suspect that it is a hybrid between a black-throated gray warbler and a Townsend's warbler, although there are some people that seem to think it's just a faded Townsend's warbler. I kind of wonder about the shape of this and particularly about the strong concentration of yellow in the lores, but I don't want to get involved in any details about that. We all know that there are hybrids between different species, so how do you deal with that? Well, these people need to read, and Lester Short came up with an idea on how you deal with hybridization, and it's entitled The Taxonomic Implications of Avian Hybridization. Now, this gets a little technical here, but let me see if I can summarize. This is the taxonomic species border. Above it, these are the kinds of forms that are parts of a single species. So if you find this kind of distribution and these kinds of interactions, they're the same species. Down here is the species border, and anything that happens down here, these are to be considered separate species. So let's look at the ones that are particularly close, because both of them involve hybridization. And that means that they hybridize in a hybrid zone, or they're potentially capable of doing so. So that means that there's a, and the way Short describes a hybrid zone is just this. The two come together, and there is a zone in which 95 or more percent of the birds in that zone are intermediate in appearance. They are hybrids. Hybrids, it's panmixia. There is no barrier to gene flow between those populations. You find a full and competent hybrid zone, that means that they are the same species. Why? Because the birds are not discriminated in mate choice. They say, I don't care if your wings are yellow or red. I'm a flicker and I'm in love with whatever you are, just for you, not because of the color of your wings. If you don't discriminate, then there is no real barrier to gene flow between these populations, and they are best described as the same species. That's why the flickers are lumped, if you were wondering. That's why the orioles got lumped. That's why anything gets lumped, is usually when there is a test of symmetry. That is, that the populations come together, and instead of overlapping each other, they hybridize like mad. So that's what a hybrid zone is. And the populations would be subspecies if they came into contact. Now let's go down here to semispecies. And these have a distribution which is basically allopatric, but they have some overlapping. That's sympetry, overlap, sympetry. So some form a zone of overlap and hybridization, or potentially capable of doing so. Competition, reinforcement, and isolating mechanisms. So you have the blue-winged warbler and the golden-winged warbler overlapping over a fairly large period of a fairly large range. What do you have? You have mostly overlap. You don't see a lot of hybrids. I used to live in the hybrid zone, or the zone of overlap and hybridization. I never saw a Brewster's warbler when I lived there. I still have never seen a Brewster's warbler alive. The same kind of thing can be said by, you know, for a whole lot of species in which they come into contact. Yeah, they might hybridize, but those hybrids are rare. And so that's the alternate sort of universe that you see. Either hybrids are really common or hybrids are extremely rare. And if the hybrids are extremely rare, we regard those as separate species because there must be a reason why it is that the hybridization is rare. And that's called an isolating mechanism. Isolating is a bad word. People think isolation must be complete isolation. Doesn't mean that. It means that there is some mechanism that is preventing free gene flow between these things. So these are referred to as isolating mechanisms. I agree that word is kind of misleading. So those are the two things. Now, he makes a big difference between hybrid zone and zone of overlap and hybridization. And right there is the difference between subspecies and species, according to Short. And here you have the Tobias system coming in there and saying, oh, a zone of hybridization means that we add to the score. That means that they're separate species. That's because they are using the term hybrid zone without ever having read this paper. They are using the term hybrid zone to mean the same thing as Short means by zone of overlap and hybridization. They're saying, okay, if they come into contact and there's some hybridization in there, that adds to the score. That makes sense if they overlap, but you don't call that a hybrid zone. That's why it is, and it took me forever to figure out what these people were talking about, and that's why the sort of words matter when you're trying to describe this kind of thing. If you're just sloppy and you use the term hybrid zone for both of these, that leaves me totally scratching my head. Anyway, so now we have pretty much decided what a subspecies is, but what is the difference between a subspecies and a valid subspecies? How do you know whether or not the differences between these populations are significant enough to give them a whole new scientific name? And the usual rule of this is that there needs to be, well, it is called the 75% rule that was essayed and advocated by Dean Abaddon. And the 75% rule says this. It says there's a problem. The way things are defined for subspecies is anybody can come along and find trivial differences between populations, and there could be considerable overlap between the individuals in one area and the other, and yet you name a subspecies there, and nobody else can identify the subspecies based on your claim that it is obviously larger or obviously brighter yellow or whatever, you know, subtle differences that you see. So this applies mostly to measurement differences, and a lot of subspecies differ in size, like one of them's larger and the other one's smaller. But you could apply this rule to any kind of difference as long as it's accessible in museum specimens. And that's the 75% rule, and it says this, that to be valid, population A, 75% of those individuals must differ from all of population B. That means that there's 25% of the population may be indistinguishable from population B. There's overlap. So an individual in population A may, by means of individual variation, be indistinguishable from some individuals of population B. So he's got this 75% rule. Now, the 75% rule is unfortunately one of the most ignored rules in all of ornithology. Because, for one thing, how different they are depends on how many characters you want to use in your description. And number two, it's just too much work to try to prove the 75% rule when you are naming a new subspecies. Plus, naming a new subspecies is not a particularly hot topic in graduate school anymore. So there aren't a lot of people even doing it. There's another alternative to the 75% rule that has been proposed, and that is the 97% rule. Under the 97% rule, 97% of population A must be distinguishable from 97% of population B. Now, which of those two rules do you think is more strict?
Bigger number.
The 97%? But remember, 97% from 97% versus 75% from 100%. Still think it's 97%? Any statisticians in here? Anybody do that kind of stuff? They're the same thing. They're exactly the same thing. Mathematically, 75% from all is the same. When you do the overlaps of the bell curves, it's the same. It's basically the same thing. So it gives you an idea of how statistics can become a little bit confusing. Now, there's all kinds of other. There's geographic variation that applies to basically all warm-blooded vertebrates, and that is Berkman's rule, Allen's rule, and Glover's rule. And most of you are probably familiar with these rules. Berkman's rule holds that among populations with large ranges, that those that live in colder climates develop or evolve larger body size to keep warm. Allen's rule says that in colder climates, birds in particular tend to evolve shorter bills and shorter legs. Why? Because you lose heat through your bill and through your legs, because there's a lot of surface area per unit volume. Glover's rule holds that in areas that are really wet, there's a lot of rainfall, pigmentation tends to be more saturated than it does in arid areas. Desert birds tend to be pale. Birds in the Pacific Northwest tend to be very dark. So that's another general rule. Now, and when we're talking about climate, understand that these are climal variation for the most part. And you may have something like a great horned owl or whatever, and you'll look at the size of the thing, and it just is gradually different, imperceptibly different over a long, long range until they, you know, they're larger or smaller or darker or lighter. And where do you draw the line as to where those subspecies should be set? Okay? And how many subspecies should be recognized within a clime? Clime is what I just described. It is a gradual change in which there is nothing abrupt about it and no real reason for you to draw a line one place or another. And the answer is, anybody know what the answer is? The answer is zero. Clinal variation is not subspecies is not a useful way to describe clinal variation. How do you describe clinal variation? You simply state there's a clime. You just state that there's a clime. You do not come up with a name. That doesn't stop people from doing this with, some of these woodpeckers where they show that there's clinal variation, and then they say, well, I'm going to arbitrarily draw a line in the middle, and this is going to be the northern woodpecker, and this is going to be the southern one. And, you know, where did you get that from? But you still see it a lot, and, some of these subspecies probably need to be eliminated, but somebody has to write a paper on how these things. The other thing about subspecies that I think is misunderstood is their status as an evolutionary unit. That is, I used to think, well, how do you get a species to happen? Well, maybe it goes through the stage of being a subspecies first, and then it evolves into a separate species. And it's real important to understand that subspecies are not evolutionary units. They are merely a way of describing geographic variation. They may be an evolutionary unit only if they are geographically isolated. Then they would have a separate evolutionary future. But they are not necessarily, in and of themselves, evolutionary units. I used to ask the question, I says, when does a subspecies become a species? And, of course, the best answer is when the AOU tells you it is. And we're seeing a lot of that as the AOU comes out with their new publications every July. And what we thought was a subspecies, they finally have decided is a full species. But that's not the real role of a subspecies. Now, let's take a look at some examples of subspecies. And these are from the National Geographic Guide. And they show the red-shouldered hawk, which I think is a real interesting example. So here is Bugio lineatus now. This one is lineatus. That, okay, in here, these are subspecific names. Everybody clear on that? So that means the full name on here is Bugio lineatus, right? Okay, so this is the nominate race. A lot of times you hear people talk about the nominate race. What's the nominate race? It is the one in which the subspecies name is the same as the species name. And your spell checker will complain about it every time. Because did you really mean to say lineatus twice? And, you know, delete your extra lineatus. And the way that works, and it's just a general rule of nomenclature, is that the nominate subspecies applies to the first population of that species that was described to science. So the very first red-shouldered hawks were described from specimens based in northeastern North America. Now there's some southern populations down here, and one way down here in southern Florida, and then there's this one, which is our red-shouldered hawk, the subspecies elegans. So what would be the full scientific name of our bird? Bugio lineatus elegans is what it is. Used to have, sometimes people apply English names to subspecies. You can do that, but be careful about it. People won't understand when you say you saw a red-bellied hawk that you really meant red-shouldered hawk. But in the context of birding in California, most of us understand red-shouldered hawk. Okay, so here's, you know, this whole area across New Mexico, basically, in which there are no red-shouldered hawks, and up in Montana there's no red-shouldered hawk. So do we know, first off, whether or not these are really red-shouldered hawks or whether they're a separate species? The answer is we have no idea. We could try to test their reproductive compatibility by putting them in a cage and seeing whether they mated with each other. A lot of people think that would be a good idea. That's not a good idea. Because putting birds in cages induces unnatural behavior. So it matters what happens when the birds have a full choice in their natural environment. So we don't know about that. And it is just as reasonable to consider the West Coast birds to be a separate species. We have no evidence one way or another. But, and I would argue this, I am personally a lumper. I feel so lonely these days. And this is why I would be opposed to lumping our red-shouldered hawks. To splitting it. And that is, by considering it to be a subspecies of the red-shouldered hawk, I am, in the nomenclature, conveying a whole lot of information that would not be available if I just called that Bugio elegans and a separate species. Bugio elegans doesn't tell me anything about it. It tells me it's a hawk, some kind of a Bugio, and I don't know if it's close to a red-tailed hawk or a red-shouldered or any other kind of a Bugio. All I know is that it's a Bugio. But by calling it Bugio lineatus elegans, I am telling everybody that reads it, number one, it is more closely related to this bird than it is to anything else. It's more closely related to the eastern red-shouldered hawks. It looks like it. It sounds like it. Yeah, it's a little smaller. It's a little bit darker. But it's closely related. What else am I telling you about it? I'm telling you that the population is allopatric. I'm telling you it doesn't overlap. Because if it overlapped, then we would know whether or not they were species or not. So just in the name, I've conveyed a whole lot of, I think, important information. And a lot of modern systematists don't seem to quite understand the value of maintaining subspecies like that, you know, just for information purposes. Because the birds don't care. They, you know, this guy has never seen one of those, so it doesn't make any difference to them. They remain what they've always been. Here are some pictures I took of our red-shouldered hawk. This demonstrates reproductive compatibility. And here is a photo I took of Extimus in the Florida Everglades. And I hope you see some differences there. It's much paler about the head, very much paler on the underparts. It's a rather, to me, a rather different-looking bird. I think they were actually nesting in that palm tree. Here's some specimens of red-shouldered hawk. And this is September 1996. The middle bird was found dead along I-5 north of Twin Cities Road in Sacramento County. And the middle bird and these on either side are elegans. This is elegans, this is elegans. But the middle bird right here seems to be, I think that's what this is. Seems to be larger, seems to be darker. Not sure about this. I hope I have this right. Anyway, this has been identified as the nominate red-shouldered hawk specimen from California. There are no site records of red-shouldered hawk, eastern red-shouldered hawks from California, but this specimen is believed to be one of those birds. There is quite a lot of controversy about this. Bill Clark thought that it was a hybrid between a red-shouldered hawk and a red-tailed hawk. Not sure why he thought that, but he did go in and get DNA off the specimen there and had it analyzed. And the last I heard was that they were able to determine that its mother was an eastern red-shouldered hawk. Not sure we know what its father was.
Joe?
Yeah.
I think maybe a year or two ago in outside Santa Rosa, the red-shouldered hawk made it with the common black hawk. Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
So what would that be? Those are two separate species, right?
Yeah. And that happens when you have something like a black hawk that is got no mate choice. It's totally outside of its normal range. So the black hawk is interested in mating, and the closest thing it could find. That's an example of very rare hybridization. That hybrid is only known from Santa Rosa. So it is not of taxonomic significance. Moving on, let's talk about some other controversies. The red-tailed hawk. And this is the western subspecies, the Rhys calurus, of the red-tailed hawk. Looks like it's got a mouse. And this one, which has no red in its tail, has got a lot of white in the tail, a little bit of narrow barring. And some of you may recognize that this is what used to be called a separate species, the Harlan's hawk. And then it got demoted to being a race of the red-tailed hawk. And that's where it sits today, in spite of some efforts to try to elevate this bird to specific status. Now, this is a common bird in California. This is a rather rare species in California. That is a map from Wheeler's 2003 wonderful book on the raptors of North America, divided into two volumes, Eastern and Western. And I just copied the map here out of Wheeler's work for the western United States. And you can see, I don't know, the colors don't look quite right, but this lavender sort of color is the breeding range. This purple color here, I mean this blue color is the winter range, like most range maps. And this blue here, this is permanent resident, this is winter range here. So this is a highly migratory, here's blotchy little locations where the bird has been found in the winter, and this is its breeding range. Now, what is wrong with this map? Does anybody see a problem with this map? Does it all look fine to you?
There's no permanent year-round graphics.
They're what? I think you're on the right track.
This map doesn't show as much as that.
Oh, yeah, they're different. They're different, slightly different scale. Well, actually, yeah, they're a slightly different scale. But the point is that there is something that I find to be really problematic about this map, and that is that they have overlapping breeding ranges, don't they? Look at Fairbanks. Fairbanks, which is right in the middle of the Harlan's red-tailed hawk range, and over here is Fairbanks, right in the middle of the western red-tailed hawk's range. And Anchorage, same thing. He's got them overlapping. If their ranges overlap like that, what are they?
Species.
They are species. They cannot be subspecies if they have overlapping breeding ranges. If you ever see a book, you know, a map like that, it's published in a book, a lot of people don't understand this. I wrote to Brian Wheeler, he's a brilliant person, he did not understand my email. And, you know, I mean, he said he had all of this data to support that that's what these were. If he's right, and that this is the actual breeding ranges of these two different subspecies of red-tailed hawk, then we are wrong in considering them to be subspecies. We would have to elevate Harlan's hawk to be a separate species if this map is completely correct. Yeah.
This might also support species, and I'm purely speculating here, but if, say, western preferred downslope conifer and Harlan's preferred deciduous forest or something upslope...
What you're talking about is ecological isolation,
right,
where you have two different populations that have overlapping breeding ranges, but they prefer different habitats, and those habitats are sort of within cruising range of each other so that they have the potential to hybridize, but the ecological isolation is preventing the hybridization. Yeah, those are very sticky problems, but in general, they are believed... In most cases, though, that would be considered to be separate species. One of the key things about a species is that each species occupies a unique niche in nature. You cannot have two species occupying exactly identical niches. Why? Because competition is going to cause one of them to go extinct over time, because one of them is going to be better adapted than the other. So what you have when you have two species overlapping each other is you frequently get ecological isolation as an isolating mechanism, actually, as a way in which they can tolerate each other without having to fight to the death. If you think about natural selection and survival of the fitness, survival of the fittest, what does that say for diversity? Why are there 10,000 species of birds? Why hadn't there been just one real strong, powerful one that ate all the others? That's not the way we are seeing diversity on the planet. We're seeing a lot of diversity, and the way that works is for different species to avoid competing directly with each other for limited resources. Okay, so there's a problem with this map. Now, that's just a problem with the map, but look, here's another map put together by people who understand what subspecies are, and this is from the National Geographic. And here you see Harlani here, and here you see Calurus and Harlani integrated zone right there. And so instead of a bunch of little spots that look like they're overlapping, this whole area is considered by National Geographic to represent a hybrid zone. He calls it integrated zone. Integrated is the same thing as hybrid zone. Okay? It means that within that area, they are completely non-discriminant in terms of mate choice, and all you find in here is a whole bunch of intermediate or intergrade type birds. Now, here's the range of Calurus, and it goes all the way down into California. That's the subspecies.
What's the difference between Calurus and Western?
That's the one we call it Western.
Okay.
Calurus. Yeah. And the eastern one is called Borealis. And then there's some other ones down in here in Texas, and you get down into the Caribbean and some very different ones the further away you get from the core. There's also something I'm not familiar with, this one, Alicensis, along the coast here. But I believe that some of those birds may, I'm not sure to what extent those are migratory. Anyway, here is a Crateri integrated zone. There's been a lot of discussion about what Crateri is. I don't want to get into that. I just want to point out that this is a reasonable interpretation, I think, of the data that we have for Harlan's Hawk right now. And without, you know, much further information, maintaining it as an Alaska subspecies is perfectly fine. Remember that there is this intergrade zone. It means that if you see some of these birds in California, it may not be a pure Harlan's. It may be one of those intergrades. In fact, the intergrade zone looks like it's larger than the range of pure Harlani, if this map is accurate. Let's talk about another one that people love to talk about, and that is the Myrtle and the Audubon's Warbler. As you and I were growing up, you are all the same age as me, right? These were separate species, and then a lump came about, and they got the awful name of yellow-rumped warbler. This is the myrtle type, and this is the Audubon's type. Now, you know that those are considered now to be subspecies groups of each other. You know, a subspecies group is just a group of subspecies that's a lot alike. So the myrtle type is the one with the white throat here and a white supercilium. This is the Audubon's with the yellow throat and no white supercilium. There, within each of these, there are a subgroups, different subspecies within a subspecies group. So you can sort of drill down, and that's okay. That is, sometimes gets confusing, but it's not an overwhelmingly difficult problem to solve. This needs to be better labeled, came from the National Geographic, but this is the breeding range of the myrtle warbler. Yellow is the migration route, and here's where it winters. And here is an intergrade zone. See where it goes? It's up here in British Columbia, and it gets a little bit into southern Alberta. So there is a narrow and small hybrid zone in there. He calls it an intergrade zone to make it clear, I think, that this is a hybrid zone and not a zone of overlap and hybridization. If he wrote hybrid zone in there, all of the people that think a hybrid zone is based on the definitions used by Handbook of the Birds of the World wouldn't know what they were, what he meant. So using the term intergrade, that is a synonym for what Short called the hybrid zone. And then here is Audubon's warbler. So its breeding range fills in a whole bunch of stuff south of where the myrtle warbler is. And notice that it also occurs as a breeder down here in parts of California. So the breeding form in California is the Audubon's type. So now, a lot of times people come and they say, are they going to split the yellow-rumped warbler? I heard they're going to split the yellow-rumped warbler. And first off, before we get into whether they're going to split the yellow-rumped warbler, let me ask you this. Have you ever gone bird watching out here and seen both the Audubon's warbler and the myrtle warbler together? Did you ever see that? Sometimes in willow thickets or even in a eucalyptus tree. So there you have overlapping subspecies. Doesn't that mean that they're separate species? What's wrong? Where did I go wrong?
They're not breeding.
They're not breeding. Remember, that overlap thing applies only for breeding or potentially breeding birds. On the wintering grounds, there's a big isolating mechanism, and that is it's not the breeding season, and nobody's breeding. So it's okay to have a map that shows overlapping subspecies in the non-breeding season. That's fine. It's just when that thing like the Wheelers when it shows the breeding season, that becomes problematic. Okay. Now, the IOC splits them. Now, who knows what IOC is? International Ornithological Congress. And they met in, I think, Australia some decades ago. And their idea was to have a group of English-speaking ornithologists from around the world come up with a full list of standard English names for every bird in the world. And they had a committee of about 15 people from around the world. After about a year or so, all but two of them quit. And the two that were left came up with this list of birds with the so-called standard English names. It was never intended to be a taxonomic list. It was just to create standardized English names. And they got into quite a furor over whether or not they would use hyphens in the names and whether or not they should have apostrophes and where the apostrophe should be and all of that. They have published in book form the IOC, International Ornithological Checklist, and it's called, I forget exactly what it's called, I'll show you the book in a minute. And this is the way, they have a downloadable spreadsheet. You can go online, look up the IOC checklist, they will give you, there are a whole bunch of different versions, but you can basically get a whole spreadsheet of every bird in the world. And here is my little clipping from the spreadsheet that I downloaded, free, of the way they have dealt with these warblers. Myrtle warbler, North America, here's its range. Audubon's warbler, North America, Middle America. Here are ranges of Audubon's warbler. Goldman's warbler, generally considered to be a race of Audubon's warbler from down in Middle America, is listed also as a separate species. So IOC, their checklist, their standard checklist of birds of the world, has three species, Myrtle, Audubon's, and Goldman's. So if you keep your checklist on IOC, you get two species and maybe three, depending on whether you've seen the Goldman's. Here, there is another checklist, and this one up here is the Clements checklist. And the Clements checklist was adopted by the ABA for world listing purposes. And it is also the checklist that is used by eBird. And they are out of Cornell University. And they also have a free downloadable spreadsheet of every single bird in the world. And they have their taxonomy and their English names. And so here is what they have. They have yellow-rumped warbler, Centifaga coronata, and then they have the different subspecies over here. Notice the subspecies are listed as trinomials, and the species is in binomial. So they have English names like yellow-rumped warbler Myrtle, yellow-rumped warbler Audubon's, yellow-rumped warbler West Mexico, yellow-rumped warbler Goldman's. And here are the ranges of those different subspecies. So you can add all of this together and you get the full range of the yellow-rumped warbler. So this is the Clements checklist adopted by ABA and by eBird, and they do not split them. Now the reason that IOC gave for splitting them was based on a paper by Brelsford and Irwin in 2009, which demonstrate a lack of free interbreeding between Audubon's and Myrtle warblers in the narrow and stable hybrid zone. Notice that the term hybrid zone and the words lack of free interbreeding do not compute. Lack of free interbreeding, the correct term would be zone of overlap. Confirm the validity of the original split. Well, wow, so there's a scientific paper that splits them. What is going on here? Well, we'll get to that, I think, in a minute, but I just wanted to show you. This is Birds of the World by Gill and Wright. This is the remnant of what was the original IOC attempt to come up with a standardized list of birds of the world. This is Clements, And this is the illustrated checklist of birds of the world, the one I suggested maybe you don't want to buy because of its weird taxonomy using the Tobias system. If you see somebody using the Tobias system, be afraid, be very afraid. Now, here is the actual paper that was published in the journal Evolution in 2009, so that's been a while. Incipient speciation, despite little assortative mating, the yellow-rumped warbler hybrid zone. First off, what is assortative mating? There are two kinds. There's positive and negative assortative mating. But if you prefer to mate with your own kind, that's called positive assortative mating. And if you can show that myrtle warblers prefer to find myrtle warblers for their mates, and Audubons prefer to find Audubons, that is positive assortative mating. And if you see that, there's a very good chance that those populations might be separate species. So they talk about little assortative mating. That's a red flag right there for me. I want to see a lot of assortative mating if they really want to do this. The yellow-rumped warbler hybrid zone. Temporal stability and limited width of the hybrid zone is one of the points that they argue. Why do they argue that? Look at this. If, in fact, these are subspecies and there is no barrier to gene flow, what would you predict would happen to the hybrid zone over time? It would expand, wouldn't it? Because on the edges, there's no barrier to mating, so the hybrid zone's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. This hybrid zone seems to be stabilized, so it does not appear to be showing the kind of thing that you would expect if these were freely interbreeding, necessarily. Assortative mating is either very weak or absent. That is a huge red flag. I want to see assortative mating in the hybrid zone. If I don't see that, then I'm seeing what looks like random mating. That's what that is. And if it's random mating, then they were right to love them. Reproductive isolation is largely due to post-mating barriers. Oh, give me a break. Look, what are post-mating barriers? Post-mating barriers are something like this. Suppose you have hybridization, but the hybrids themselves are at a selective disadvantage. The hybrids are shunned and cannot find mates. That might be an example of a post-mating post-mating barrier. But if you find that, and that same kind of thing has been found with like the Bullocks and the Baltimore Oriole, for example, that does support the idea that there is an isolating mechanism. But I don't see that they have shown that there really is reproductive isolation after they have said that assortative mating is weak. Despite extensive hybridization, they admit there's extensive hybridization. The two forms are distinct evolutionary groups. Well, duh. That's fine. That is fine, except that that's the phylogenetic species concept. They're distinct evolutionary groups. You can argue that, but that does not make them biological species. They could just as easily apply to subspecies. So, in general, here's what happened. IOC saw this paper. IOC tends to jump. Whenever anybody makes a recommendation in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, they go in there and they make that change right away. This is why a lot of list crazy bird watchers love the IOC. Clements doesn't do that. Clements, first off, follows the AOU for North American birds and is very slow to adopt changes until they have become well-established or the cases are very, very clear. This is not a clear case. This is a hodgepodge mess, honestly. And I've talked to people on the AOU committee and they tell me, you know, we went back and we looked at the original data and, you know, even though they would love to split those birds, and everybody here would love to be able to get a new bird on your list, there was just no other way of interpreting that data than to keep them as one species. Now, a lot of people, you know, get excited about some of these subspecies, and suddenly Birding Magazine is featuring white-breasted nuthatch subspecies as a cover. And here are some populations of white-breasted nuthatch, and they have different vocalizations, and they look a little bit different, and they don't migrate a whole lot. You know, the question about whether or not they deserve to be full subspecies, it looks a full species. It looks like maybe there are a few separate species that are hidden in here. And a lot's been written about it, and there's a lot. And these are called cryptic species, in which the birds look more or less the same. The differences are slight. There appears to be some validity to the idea of considering these. But then nobody had studied the one down in Mexico. There's been proposals to split this white-breasted nuthatch. People like to, once they hear there's a split in the works, everybody suddenly is interested in those subspecies. And they start talking about, you know, Culiata white-breasted nuthatch. And when you enter the white-breasted nuthatch into your eBird list, it'll even give you the subspecies if you want to. Do any of you do eBird? Do you do subspecies? No? Yes, one person does subspecies. You have the opportunity to put subspecies in there, and those are usually recognizable subspecies that eBird and Clements think are worth noting if you want to keep track of your subspecies. What's the advantage of that? Is when the AOU finally does split the white-breasted nuthatch, you can get a brand new bird on your list without actually having to go bird watching. This one just happened this summer. The western scrub jay is no more. Does everybody know about this? Yeah. This is the California scrub jay now. There's no longer such a thing as a western scrub jay. Oh, that name could be used for the whole complex. And everything east of this line is called the Woodhouse Jay. And you know which one is which? The top one is which? Woodhouse, exactly. It's got no collar. It's a much blurrier color on the back. This is our coastal California scrub jay. We already split off that Santa Cruz Island scrub jay, which some of you have probably gone to Santa Cruz Island to see. So this was just the next one on the sort of dominoes. But basically, this is where the line is between those two. And they come into contact on the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada. So these are the ones that we see here. They're now called California scrub jay. But if you have been on the east side of the Sierra Nevada and the south, not up north, but in the south over here, and have seen scrub jays over there, like some of these places, that would have been the Woodhouse jay. So you can add Woodhouse jay to your California list and your life list. If you knew that it was a Woodhouse jay at the time, and you have notes that describe the differences between it and the coastal California jay, if you just said, I have scrub jay on my, I saw a scrub jay there, it looked just like every other scrub jay I've seen, then you have, look, it's your list. I'm not going to tell you you can't count it, but it would be so much more satisfying to your soul if you really had notes about that. Yes?
How extensive is the California scrub jay? What about the differences?
Yeah.
If I saw it in Colorado, was it probably the Woodhouse?
Yes, Colorado is definitely Woodhouse. This is the line right here. So Superciliosa is in California. We have the Race Californica here right along the coast. The ones that get all the way up into Modoc County, though, those are still California scrub jays. It's down in here from like Inyo County down through Clark Mountain and the Inyo Mountains and places like that, and probably up, I'm not sure if it gets up to Mono Lake or not. I'm not sure exactly where the dividing line is on there. There's only one spot where they come together, they're both pretty darn rare at that particular spot, so there isn't a lot of hybridization. Fox sparrows. A lot of interest in fox sparrows suddenly. And these are breeding ranges, and gosh, this thing is a big mess. But there's a red group, and then there's a sooty group, and then there's a thick-billed group, and a slate-colored group. So basically, there are four groups, and then within each group, there's a whole bunch of subspecies with impronounceable names that are part of the different, each different subspecies group. But as far as field identification is concerned, we can identify the red group, the slate-colored group, the thick-billed, and the sooty groups fairly easily. This is an example of the red group, probably Zaboria from Alaska. They come down, and rarely do we winter down here in California. Anybody ever see one of these in California? A couple of you. And this is the type that we usually see. This is in my backyard. This is the racing nectens. It's part of the sooty group, and they are from breeding grounds up in Alaska. And they've just arrived, by the way, in the last week or so in my yard, and perhaps in your yard, too. This is a big, thick-billed bird, and this is part of a population. Stephan's eye is one subspecies. Monoensis, I think, is another. These are what breed in the Sierra Nevada, and they look really different from the ones that winter here on the coast. You might think they're a separate species. Not only that, they have a different song. They sound sort of like a green-tailed towhee, and they have a very different appearance and a different chick note. You know, that really thick, husky call of the fox sparrow? These give a call that sounds like a California towhee. And then these look quite a bit like these, which are slate-colored, which are found in, well to the east. But they do winter with some regularity in California, and I do see them from time to time. Notice that the streaks on the flanks are well-defined on both of these. This one here, look at the flanks on that. It's all dark. The chest is almost all dark. You can hardly call it even spotted. These sound like ours, though. These sound like the typical husky fox sparrows. This one that seems to be really different, even though it looks a little bit more like this. So there are these four different populations of fox sparrows. By the way, this type, I've never seen away from the mountains. It seems to winter in mountains in Baja, and rarely seems to show up in the lowlands of California. There are some specimens, but I rarely see that. Let's take a look at the winter range, again, out of the National Geographic. So the sooty group winters here. Slate-colored and thick-billed groups are down in here. And the red group is in the east. So the ones that are in the red group that bred up here are mostly wintering here. That is where I grew up. That's where we saw the red group. But there are subtle differences, like you can take a look within the sooty group. And remember that complicated thing that had a whole bunch of names. Well, here they are again. And these are the breeding ranges up here, circled in blue, of each different subspecies. And if you really want to get into looking at birds in a different way, start to sort out the subspecies of sooty fox sparrow that you might be seeing in your area. There is Bunalashensis way up here. Look where it winters. Bunalashensis insularis and sinuosa all winter further south than Anectens. Anectens is the one that winters mostly in the Bay Area. That's the one I showed you a picture of. Townsend eye goes down here into Northern California and Oregon. And this one here, Fuliginosa, is essentially resident. This is called leapfrog migration. And the reason we know that about this leapfrog migration is because of museum specimens. We collect the museum specimens on the breeding grounds and compare them with what we find on the wintering grounds. And we see that these are the normal breeding and wintering ranges of these different subspecies. So by paying attention to the subtle differences in these subspecies, we can learn something that would be totally unexpected otherwise. I mean, who knew that the ones that they actually leapfrog over each other? Now, how are you going to get information? Well, I'll tell you how to get information on how to identify those subspecies in a minute. But I just want to quickly go through a couple of others. Geez, I said this was going to be brief and I lied. Savannah sparrow is one that people talk about. These are a very complicated, interesting bird. But who would have ever thought that was a Savannah sparrow? That's the large, what brilliant person decided that this was a Savannah sparrow? It's the large-billed sparrow from Mexico. It has occurred in the Bay Area. I think there was one out at Abbott's Lagoon one time. I would have loved to have known about it, you know. But anyway, look at the thing. It looks more like a purple finch than anything else. So there's a huge amount of variation and a lot of dispute over what species limits are in the Savannah sparrow. Right now, it looks to me like they're all considered to be subspecies. Juncos. People have been arguing about juncos ever since anybody first looked at a junco. Here are the different groups of juncos. They all used to be like separate species, and now they're like all one species right now. Except I think they finally split off something from down in Mexico. But here is the subspecies Pinosus, which is in my yard. And here is this one, which looks sort of like a pink-sided type junco. See how pink that is, and it sort of grays in there? I thought that this was the best chance I ever had of a real pink-sided junco in my yard, and I took a bunch of photos and sent them to a bunch of people. And the answers were 50% of them thought it was probably a pink-sided junco, and the other 50% thought it probably wasn't. Here is my bird, and here is a real pink-sided junco photographed within its range. You can decide for yourself whether or not I saw a pink-sided junco or not. Well, they're common in Colorado, actually. And they do winter a little bit in extreme southern California. But the pink-sided junco is a subgroup of the sort of Oregon junco. We call ours Oregon junco. Pink-sided, the males have an all-gray head. So, but the females are, you know, gray-headed in both. And there seems to be some overlap. Plus, these are subspecies. So they hybridize in zones of contact. So why don't we get some kind of wishy-washy ones that maybe we can't really assign to a particular, give it a name? Do we have to give everything a name? Maybe we should just appreciate birds for what they are and enjoy them for what they are and forget about all of this identification stuff. If you really want to get accurate portrayals of the different subspecies, my favorite website is birdorable.com. Here are these highly accurate renditions of the different subspecies of dark-eyed junco. Now, if you really want to get into this, how do you know what the ranges are or the expected breeding ranges of these things might be? Well, there are a lot of different sources, but one place you could go to is Grinnell and Miller's book on the distribution of the birds of California, published back in the 1940s, I think 1944 or something like that. And here is the range map showing three different subspecies of dark-eyed junco. Thurberi is the one that's in Marin, by the way. And the one down here, Pinosus, is a little bit brighter. So there is a barrier sort of between Marin and San Francisco, between two different subspecies of junco. Remember, these are breeding ranges, and then Canisteps is like way over here, so that is more or less irrelevant to this mountain population, but the ones that they examine for Marin County are Thurberi, and the ones in my yard, the ones that breed in my neighborhood, are the more brightly colored Pinosus. Now, where do you get this? Well, this whole thing is available for free as a download. There's a PDF you can get off of SORA, Searchable Ornithology Research, you know, if you know where that is. Dig it out, and it was published as, by the UC Berkeley contributions in zoology, something like that. It might take you, depending on your speed of your internet, a couple of hours to get the whole thing. But then it's searchable, and you've got it. And it's out of print. The book itself, I thought, was great. 1918, my favorite ornithologist, Jonathan Dwight, M.D., wrote an analysis of the juncos. and I won't go into this in a whole lot of detail, but basically, Dwight was looking and analyzing the Junco distribution, and he found some Juncos within the range of one subspecies that exactly resembled something else, a different subspecies. And he says, you know, if we were naming these based on how they appear, we would give them that name. And this is called typological thinking. Remember, it's the population. And if even if it looks just like this other subspecies, if it's breeding right here and they are all part of the same group, they are defined as that subspecies, and everything else is individual variation. And individual variation can certainly make one individual happen to resemble an individual of a separate subspecies. That's when I started to point out that it's not the bird that is a subspecies, but the population that it lives in. But in 1918, not all of that was as clear as it is today. What are some other possible uses for the subspecies concept? Here is Jerry Ting's photo of a poor will in October 2013 in the Berkeley Meadows. Now, anybody knows anything about poor wills or knows anything about the Berkeley Meadows knows that there should not be a poor will in the Berkeley Meadows in October. And here is a photograph of that. So what was that poor will doing? We know very little about the biology or distribution or migration of poor wills, but presumably this bird migrated there. And it turns out, if you looked at Grinnell and Miller, that there are two important ones and one not so important, subspecies of the poor will. And here is his distribution. The cross-hatched thing is Californicus. And this vertical thing that goes up here and includes all of Nevada with the vertical cross-hatching is Nuttalli. And Nuttalli is, in fact, the nominate subspecies. So now you would expect that if you look at these dots are actually specimens that have been examined cited in the literature. You would expect that in the Berkeley Meadows, that would be Californicus. Here are some of the differences between Californicus and Nuttalli. And these photos that were taken by my colleague Phil Unit show dorsal and side views of Californicus and Nuttalli. And the main thing to take home from this is that these are paler and grayer. And Phil says these are colored like granite and these are colored like leaf litter. And that really is the kind of difference in the habitat between the two, that our coastal poor wills are much browner. You're not going to find this in a field guide. This is going to take a little bit of effort to be able to dig this out. Most of the time we're just lucky we see a poor will of any kind. But if you go back, I think that's colored like granite. I think that's a grayback bird. And in fact, I think that that illustrates the importance of being able to use subspecies as a marker for what populations some of these migratory birds come from. This is telling us something, and just a few weeks ago, somebody photographed a poor will in a cemetery in the Central Valley, and it was also a gray bird, also this type. So I think, and you know, can you imagine non-calling poor wills migrating at night? What are your chances of seeing one of those? We have no idea how many poor wills there might be around. We have no way of really censusing them. But from the basis of some of these photos, it suggests that they are not necessarily the ones that you would expect. One of my favorite birds are chickadees. And here is Grinnell and Miller's map of the subspecies of chestnut-backed chickadee in 1944. So north of Marin County is Rufescens. That's the nominate race. In Marin County, there's something called Neglectus, and from San Francisco south with something called Barlowa. These birds differ in the amount of rusty or chestnut color on the sides and flanks. Now, as you may know, the chickadee has expanded its range. And here is a recent map that shows not just California, but even for California, you can see the range extension in the Sierra foothills, and it extends further down all the way to into Santa Barbara County now. Basically, these are all rufescens from here all the way up to Alaska. Here is the Marin chickadee, which was described, I believe, by Grinnell, which has a little bit of rusty in the flanks. And here is Rich Stolkup's warning about what seems to be happening with the chestnut-backed chickadee, in that there seems to be rufescens coming in from Sonoma into Marin County. These are population shifts since 1944. This is the 1944 range. And these are the directions that the bird has been moving. These Barlowi from San Francisco have moved across. They are now a common bird in the East Bay, for example. They did not, it's hard to believe that in 1944 there were no chickadees in Oakland or Berkeley or, you know, now they're all the way out to Walnut Creek and Mount Diablo. And these rufescens are coming into Napa and Solano, so there's a lot of movement that's going on there. But his concern, and it's an interesting one, is that the Marin chickadee, if it hybridizes with the nominate rufescens from Sonoma, if Sonoma comes in down here, we may end up with a Marin chickadee which is no longer recognizable after a period of time. And this is an example of Barlowi. This is the one that lives where I live. It's got very little rusty on the sides and flanks. This is Pacifica, San Mateo County. This is rufescens. So this is from Sonoma County North. And this is a photo of something that is believed to be neglected. The Marin County chickadee. So you have in Marin County an endemic chickadee. I hope you all knew that.
What is it called?
It's called neglecta.
Neglecta.
Or the Marin chickadee, if you want to. Oh. Now, some of you may have been around in 1976 when the pop artist Christo hung this curtain or fence that went from Bodega Bay all the way across the hills into Petaluma. And there was a lot of discussion about it at the time. But most people did not realize what the true purpose of that fence was, which was to draw a line between two subspecies of chestnut-backed chicken. And as you look at the habitat where this fence was hung, and it was a temporary thing, you might get an idea what the barrier to dispersal may have been between the Marin chickadee and the Sonoma chickadee, or the nominate chickadee, and that is, what do you see here? No trees. And so there's this open area, and think about chickadees. Do they like to fly long distances out in the open? No, they need to have trees around. So this was a fairly barren thing, and Christo realized that, and so this is, I call this Christo's line, which is you may have heard of Wallace's line and all of that if you study evolution. This is Christo's line, and very well documented. Now, there are subspecies that nobody ever wants to talk about. There are these that are, you know, that are famous, and they, you know, Birding Magazine gets cover photos, but nobody talks about pygmy nuthatches. And I am fascinated by pygmy nuthatches. This is the coastal one. Look at the difference in the crown color between the ones in the mountains, Melanotus and nominate Pygmaei, that we have here. And to me, these sound quite different. And there's been some studies that indicate that vocalizations in chickadees are species-specific. So, but nobody's working on these things. Let's take a look at the range of the different subspecies of pygmy nuthatch. And there you can see Pygmaei. It is here in scattered spots along the coast. It's much more well-established now. It used to be confined to sort of closed-cone pine forests, but now it's in eucalyptus and Monterey pine and everything else. And this is what you see up in the Sierra, Melanotus, all up in here. And it looks to me like there's something else. Where is this? I can't quite even read this map. Anybody figure out where Lucanucha is? Is that down here somewhere? Maybe in some of the transverse ranges in Southern California. Here's a modern map from Cornell, I believe. It shows the year-round. This is not a highly migratory bird. By the way, pygmy nuthatches are now in the East Bay. That's another bird that didn't used to be here. But look at this. Look, this is just wonderful. This looks like green measles, you know, has come out onto the, you know, the entire western United States. And these birds are isolated from each other. Each one of those populations may have a unique evolutionary past. There could be all kinds of cryptic species hiding in that map. Somebody needs to go in there, they need to analyze them, take a look at them, and see what's going on. But, you know, you just need to get funding or some other reason to do it, and it is an extraordinarily complex situation when you look at a range map that's anything like that to find out like what kind of dispersal there is across mountain ranges and how unique. I should never say how unique, whether or not the populations are unique or not. So, if you want to learn more about subspecies, where do you get the information? Because a lot of it doesn't seem to be readily available. Well, a lot of it is in modern field guides, particularly National Geographic. And National Geographic has these little subspecies names written cryptically around the plates, and some discussion on that. But, of course, nobody has all of the subspecies. You're certainly not going to find that in a field guide. Sibley has subspecies groups, but he refuses to name what subspecies they are. Instead, he says, you know, Midwestern prairie race or something like that. And he has a reason for doing that. If you really want information, Birds of North America Online. And when I first got on the internet, I said, I'm never going to pay for a website. I pay for this one. And it is an online version of the successor to Bent's Life Histories of North American Birds. These are now hosted by Cornell University. They have species accounts of every breeding species in North America, full life histories, fully referenced, fully up to date for the most part, and detailed descriptions of subspecies and the relations between these different species. Very authoritative, and it's about the first place I go to when somebody has a question about any particular bird. It is well worth it. I think that it costs something like $40 or $45 a year, but when you check out for 1 year, put eBird in the box for discounts, and you will get it for $25. You need to be an eBird member to do this. An eBird membership is free, so do that. Become an eBird member. Start putting all of your field trip lists onto eBird. Remember that if your lists and notes are on paper or in a box or on 3x5 cards and you die, the chances are those notes will die with you. But if all of your data is in eBird, you will be immortal. Those observations will be there forever. And they are pretty well funded through Cornell University. Bent's Life Histories, this is Arthur Cleveland Bent here. Some of you may have his wonderful old life histories. Those subspecies are not completely up to date, but he had separate species accounts, separate life histories for every subspecies from the fourth edition of the AOU checklist. So if you have that, it's a good place to look. Rare old books like Ridgway, for example, Ridgway's Manual of North American Birds, you know, that's just a... if you wondered who Ridgway was, remember we've got the Ridgway Dreidel now. That's who he was. He was working at the Smithsonian. And now you can find details on subspecies on Facebook, of all places. And Facebook has a feature called Groups. Now, you've probably thought Facebook was just a total waste of time. And I agree. But if you want to know about subspecies of fox sparrow or song sparrow, both of those species have a group that is devoted entirely to people posting photos of song sparrows and fox sparrows and asking each other which subspecies they think it is and why. So lots and lots of discussion, and lots of really fine detail, and people that are really into this. And so you can, this is Matthew Dodder, who has created the Song Sparrow Facebook group, and that's a fascinating thing. I didn't even touch on it. He created a series of non-universal stamps, 44 cents, with each subspecies written on the edge there, so you can get an idea of what that is. So if you were wondering why subspecies are important or why you might want to care about subspecies, I hope that I have piqued your interest, that you might want to learn a little bit more about it than what I just said, and I just basically touched the surface. In some cases, when there is a critical difference between sometimes the Swainson's thrushes get misidentified as Beeries, for example, you need to know about the Ustilatus subspecies of the Swainson's thrush and how red it is, for example. So if you didn't know about that and were using just the idea that the bird needs to look like this, you might make a mistake in identifying species. You might start looking at birds a little bit more carefully. It's not just a fox sparrow. Is it a Anectens or is it Sinuosa? Both of them are possible in the area. How do I tell Anectens from Sinuosa? Maybe I'll get on Facebook and I'll ask it what this one is or take a picture. Clarifies migration routes. Or, in the case of the scrub jay, if you have good notes and you've been paying attention to these subspecies, the way things are going on, and if you're interested in listing, you might get a new list, a new tick on your list without having to actually go bird watching. It's called banking. And that is seeing a bird because, and maybe even going out of your way to see a bird, not because it's listable or tickable now, but because there's talk. And you want to be prepared to keep your list up to date. So you can always do that. So with that, I don't know what I did here, but I think I'm done. I don't know what happened there. Sorry, but here, let me just fix this. Well, I went through this, and I thought I got it all done, and that's all in time. So thank you for that. Can we get some lights and maybe if there's time for questions? I don't know. Any questions? Yes?
As you talk through it, I sense there's a lot of discussion within the whole group of people that look at this whole field. And if you looked at the whole thing, where do you fit on the continuum? You must have a lot of people that agree with you, a lot of people that disagree with you.
Well, first off, I am not an authority on anything, really. I'm old school, basically. I mean, I'll tell you, the book that made the most difference in my development in this stuff was a thing called Animal Species and Evolution, which was published in the 1940s by Ernst Mayr. And I started off with his definition of what a subspecies is. And he was a lumper. And, I am very much influenced by his writing. Yes?
You only get subspecies in populations that are increasing?
No, you can have very rare populations, little islands, for example. Here's the thing. There's a couple of different ways you can get subspecies. But the subspecies need to have disjunct, abrupt differences between population A and population B. So if they come into contact, maybe there's a little bit of hybridization, or they can be completely isolated. Like, for example, there's a population of horned larks that's on one of the Channel Islands, and it's all streaky underneath. Insularis, I think, is the race of horned lark. Very different looking from any other horned lark that you might see. Now, being on an island, it has the potential to evolve to be a separate species, but it also has the potential to go extinct. And you know, so by the same token, you know, you've got evolution and extinction sort of going on. It's very active on in isolated geographic populations like island ecosystems and also mountaintops, things like that, where you have areas of high endemism. So, it all depends. I sort of see where you're getting at. If you have a species that occurs only really rare, how does it get to have more than one subspecies? It doesn't. It's just, I sort of see your point. I think I better understood your point than I did before. But, you know, certainly on an island, a tiny little population could easily be a different subspecies from the mainland. But if you have a tiny little population that's confined to a small geographic area, it makes no sense to identify multiple subspecies within a tiny little population like that. But it could be part of another, something else. Anything else? You understood all of that?
Yeah. I just wonder if you could talk about the state of Washington and the gulls in the western
coast. I'm sorry. Oh, you want to know about gulls? Glaucous wing gulls.
Yeah,
this is a question that comes up. Okay, most of the problems with gulls have to do with the glaucous wing gull, which does not seem to understand the species, biological species concept. It seems like it is willing to mate with anything that it comes into contact with in some areas. In other areas, it seems to understand that it is a glaucous wing gull and it should act like one and behave itself. It is a mess. And there are cases where this neat system doesn't quite fit. And in the case of the glaucous wing gull is one of those cases. But let me put it to you this way. If, in fact, these birds are, speciation is an evolutionary process, should we be surprised that there are cases of evolutionary intermediacy where some populations are on the cusp of being a species or not being a species? And glaucous wing gull is probably one of those cases. There is also some issues with Thayer's gull and some of those others. But the situation with the glaucous wing gull, look, there's places where there are breeding colonies with western gull and they are almost completely no hybridization. Then there's other places nearby where there's extensive hybridization. How do you deal with that? You don't. You could go either way if you wanted to. The current system is to consider glaucous wing gull to be one species and western gull to be a separate species. I would not be real happy with lumping the glaucous wing gull with the western gull because of some localized zones, hybrid zones. And here's another thing that people often look at. They try to look at evolutionary direction, and that is, over time, are you seeing a difference? This is what happened with the Orioles. When the Bullock's Oriole and the Baltimore Oriole were originally separated from each other by the Great Plains, that had relatively few trees, and they did not come into contact. And then the big trees grew up along the Platte and a lot of these horizontal rivers, and the Baltimores were coming in from here, and they finally met the Bullocks, and they hybridized like crazy when they first met, which is why we got the Northern Oriole. Some of you might remember the days of the Northern Oriole. Anybody remember that? And then what happens is you go back and you look at the hybrid zone 10 years, 20 years later, and they're no longer hybridizing. So what's happened is that the hybrids turned out to be at a selective disadvantage, and so gradually they started to behave differently. So you're dealing with behavior, you know, behavior sort of precedes taxonomy, if you will. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you all for your kind attention. I appreciate it.